Okay, we're beginning here at 13 lines down on the top of Kuf Yud Bet Amud Aleph, Tanur Banan. Hagozelu Machilet Banav, person who steals and gives it to his children to eat, Durim Milishalem, then they are patur from having to return the item. Hey Niach Lifnehem, on the other hand, if he didn't give it to them to eat, but rather left it to them, the Gdolim Chayavim Lishalem, the children who are of age are then required to return the item. On the other hand, the minors are exempt from having to return the item. Now, as far as the Gdolim, we're going to have to say, Barami Barchama, that this is a case where it's Lifnei Yeush. Because for him, if it was already after Yeush, you now have Yeush and Shinui Rishut, and then even the Gdolim would have no obligation to return it. Or you would have to say that it's in situation in which the item is a discrete item which is noticeable as a gneva, and therefore there might be an additional requirement to return it, even if there was yeush vishinui reshut. As far as the ktanim, the minors being patur from returning the item, even though it's extant over here, is because we'll see later on in the Gemara, it follows the shita of Sumchus, who says that ktanim are pturim, minors are patur from having to return the gzela, even if it is extant. V'imamru gdolim, if the Gdolim make a claim, Einanu Yodim Cheshbonot Shechishev Avinu Imcha, if the Gdolim make a claim that we have no idea what business dealings or transactions took place between you and our father, Turim, then they are Patur. Umar says, Mishum Damre Einanu Yodim Turim, just because they say we don't know, they are Patur. Rashi over here says, well, you have a Bari claim, you have a definitive claim from the Nigzal, who says the father stole it. And the children saying, we don't know. So we have a Bari and a Shema. Bari trumps a Shema, and therefore they should be obligated to pay. Now that's not so clear because, as we know, there is a machloket whether Bari v'Shema, Bari Adif, and therefore it's not everyone is in agreement about that fact. But what you have to say here is that not only is it the fact that there's a Bari and a Shema, but also the fact that the Gdolim are acknowledging the fact that there was a theft here. It's not simply that they are saying, we don't know about the whole case, but rather they are acknowledging that it was stolen, but they don't know if there was any restitution made, if it was paid back, or what type of deal that they came to in order to rectify that situation. So since they are admitting at least to the underlying fact that there was a gzelah, that's more incriminating, and therefore when they say, Einanu Yodim, what happened after that point in time, that's not enough to exempt them from having to pay in this instance. So Amar Rava, Rava explains this braita, Hachi Kamar, this is what's meant over here. Gidolim Shamru Yodimanu Cheshbonot Shechishev Avinu Imcha, Velo Pashlecha Gabei, Velo Midei Pturim. It's the other way around. The Gdolim, if the children of age say, we know what type of transactions or interactions you had with our father, and you have nothing left here. He cleared everything out. There's nothing left to discuss. Tosafot over here points out that the only way we can say this is in a case where the Gdolim here have a Migo. A Migo that either we returned it to you, or relies on a Pesha Asu or Pesha Hitir. And that is because if we know that the Gzela is in their hands, then why should their statement have any bearing over here? Why should they be ne'eman, believed in this case? So the only two scenarios that Tosfot points out that they would believe with this ta'ana, with this claim, is that if they are the ones who are telling us that the gzela is here, and since they are the ones who are telling us that it's stolen, they're also the ones who are telling us that there is no claim here. And that's what we call a pesha osur, a pesha hitir. So that would be one way in which they'd believe. Tosfot brings the other possibility, which is that even though there might be edim to the gzela, there are no edim that the item is actually in their hand at this point in time. And since there are no edim to the fact that the item is in their hand, they can make a claim of hechzanu lecha, that we returned it to you. So in either case, there's some sort of lack of evidence here, which gives them believability with their claim that there's nothing here because they could have made an alternative claim or a better claim. In the case, again, that they are the ones who are admitting that the fact that there's gzela, the only reason we know there's theft is because of their admission, and therefore a pesha sur, a pesha hitir. They're the ones incriminating themselves, and so they are the ones also saying that there's nothing left to discuss anymore. Or, if we say that there's evidence of gzela, but no evidence that they're holding the item. And the only requirement for them to return the item is if it's in hand now. And therefore, they can say, we returned it to you because we have no evidence it's in their hand. Then they can also say that their deal was closed or he paid you money and he took care of the situation. And therefore, you have no claim against us because you can't prove the fact that we're holding the item right now. And we could have made a claim that we returned it, since we could have said that when we say now that you have no claim because you worked out something with our father. They are believed in that case because of amigo. So Tosva brings those two possibilities as to why they are turim in this case. Tanidach, we have an alternative braita, a gozel umachilet banav, turim. So it opens in the same way, that a person who steals and then gives it to his children to consume, that they are turim milish shalem. They don't have to pay back because the item is now gone, and the children have no obligation of returning it once it's gone. On the other hand, if he left it to them, bachalum, and then they ate it, ben gdolim, ben ktanim, chayavim. Whether they are of age or they are minors, they are chayavim. Now, as Tosfos points out, there were girsaot that asked, isn't there a stira between the brightot over here? The previous brightot said ktanim are turim. This brightot says ktanim chayavim. But he eliminates that girsa because of what Rashi says over here, which is that this is the Rabbonon's opinion. We're going to see later on a braita between Sumchus and the Rabbonon, a machloket as to whether ketanim are chayavim in these instances. One of the braitot is authored by Sumchus, the previous one, and this braita is authored by the Rabbanan. So there is no steer in the braitot because we can say they're authored by two different tanaim. The question is, ketanim mi mechayvet? How can you make the ketanim, the minors over here, obligated to make a payment? Lo yuela the azik azuke. Why should it be any different than them doing damage to someone's property? Forget about the fact that they're holding on to gzela over here, and they ate it, where they weren't the ones who stole it, and they just ate it, they just consumed it. In a case where they actively went out and did the damage, they would not be held liable. We saw that in a Mishnah earlier in the Masechta, that ketanim are not considered to be bnei dat. When they go up and out and do hezek, they're not responsible for those actions. They don't have to pay for those actions. Amar Papa, hochi kamar. Rapapa says, this is the way to explain the braita. Heniach lifnehem, v'adayin lo achlum. It's a case where he left it, and they have yet to eat the item, meaning that the object is still extant. Ben gdolim, ben ktanim, chayavim. And whether they're gdolim or ktanim, they are responsible to return the item in that case. And again, this is the shitat chachamim, who believe that the ktanim, when the object is extant, do have an obligation to return it to the original owner. Now, Tosfos points out, the truth is that the Gemara could have asked from the Gdolim over here, not just the Ktanim, because in the case where the item is consumed, there is no obligation on the Gdolim to return the item as well. It's only when it's their father, he has an obligation to return it, whether it's extant or not. The children only have the obligation when it's extant. But if it's already consumed, the children, no matter what age, don't have any obligation. So they could have asked from the Gdolim as well, because the Rav Chisda, if it's after Yeush, or for Rami Bachama, even if it's before Yeush, in that case, there should be no obligation for them to return the item. Nevertheless, as Tosfot says, that they asked from the case of the Ktanim, which is much more obvious, and then they had to emend the Braita anyway, and the emendation of the Braita answers both questions about the Ktanim and Gdolim, since we eliminate the word Va'achalum and change it to Veloachalum. Amarava, Heiniach lehem aviem parash ula. Their father left them a ox, a cow that was borrowed. Mishtamshim ba kol yemei shelata. They have the right to utilize it for the remainder of time period that it was borrowed for. They basically inherit the right from their father to continue to utilize this item based on the time frame or the agreement that was between the father and the lending party. Meita, if the animal dies, ein chayavin beonseha. They are not responsible for anything that happens to the item. The reason being, because their right to use it comes because they inherited that right from their father. As far as the obligations are concerned, their father entered into those obligations. They did not enter into those obligations. And that's because Rovo believes that the obligation to take care of the animal and the obligations vis-a-vis anything that happens to the animal by a shoel, which means that you're chayav for everything, aside from meita machmat melacha, stem from the original agreement between the borrower and the lender. And so since those are generated at the time of the lending itself, the children weren't a party to that borrowing. Although there are Rishonim like the Rashba that indicate over here, from an equitable standpoint, the fact that these children are utilizing the animal means that they are beneficiaries of the borrowing, and therefore they should have some responsibility. It may not be up to the level of a Shoel, it may only be on the level of a Shomer Sachar. They are getting benefit, they are getting Sachar from the animal working, and therefore that generates for them the equivalence of a Shomer Sachar relationship, and therefore they will be responsible if there is Pshia, Gneva, Veda. They just may not be Chayav for Unsin like a Shoel. So to be equitable, they believe that the Yitomim are not off the hook completely, but they just don't have the obligations up to the level of a Shoel. Kisvurim shel avivim hi, if the animal is borrowed, if they thought it belonged to their father, v'tavchua v'achlua, they shechted it and they ate it. Mishamim d'mei basar b'zol, they pay back the cheap value of meat. Rashi over here says that the cheap value of meat is based on a Gemara in Baba Batra that says whenever we're talking about cheap, it means 2/3 of the regular price or a 1/3 discount. Meaning instead of there being 6 danke and azuz, that you would use 4 danke and azuz, you would only give them 2/3 of the normal value of the animal. And Rashi explains the reason why is because had they known that this was not their father's animal, they might have foregone eating the meat. They may not have spent that money in order to buy it. So we ask them to pay back d'mei basar b'zol. The Ramban, on the other hand, says here, it seems that they should only have to pay back mashenenu, what they benefited. They benefited here from basar. They may have eaten meat, but not this type of expensive meat. And therefore, we look for the cheapest meat on the market. And we assume that that's what they benefit that they derived from this, and they paid the meat. Basar b'zol means the cheapest meat in the market, not the real value or quality of meat that they ate over here. Because had they known, once again, they may not have eaten it. Heniach lehem avihem achreut nechasim. On the other hand, if their father left them what seems to be karka land over here, upon which there could be a lien, chayavim leshalim, they are obligated to pay. It's unclear about this statement the Rava makes as to whether it's modifying or qualifying the Seifa, the latter case, or the Reisha, the case about Shoel. Ika d'matni la Reisha, some say it's qualifying the Reisha. Ika d'matni la Seifa, and some say it's qualifying the second case. Man d'matni la Reisha, the one who says it's qualifying the first case, which is that the father left them a parashi ula, and then they utilize it, and then it dies, and they're not responsible for it. Kosha kena Seifa. Then certainly they would say in the latter case that they are responsible, because in the Reisha case, the transaction that generated the borrowing from the lender also generated the obligation to turn the item. And Rovo the Shita To believes that that obligation for any damage or any onus that happens is generated at the moment of the lending. And therefore the lender has a lien on the borrower's property from that moment for any damage or anything that happens, as if there's like a deposit that's been given to guarantee the fact that he gets his animal back. Since he had a lien on the land, after he passes away and something happens to the animal, that lien he can then go and exercise against the land of the individual who passed away, even though it died under the auspices of the Yorshim. And certainly in the Seifa case, where it was their father's fault, where he didn't let them know that this didn't belong to him, and so there's a certain amount of pshia here, which would obligate the father or generate the lien. And therefore, of course, you could collect in the case where they shechted the animal and ate the animal, because that's, in a sense, a pshia, much more so than the case of the reisha. Upliga de Rav Papa. And this argues on the position of Rav Papa, which we're going to see in a second, that Rav Papa believes that the obligations that surround a shoel or problems that arise in the relationship generate an obligation at the time that those problems arise, not from the original agreement or transaction between the borrower and the lender. Matamati la Seifa, the one who says that the qualification applies to the latter case, that is because in the latter case, the father is really a posheya. He didn't inform the children of the fact that this animal didn't belong to him. And therefore, since he is in a sense a posheya, that's why there's a lien on his property. Aval Reisha lo, by the case of the Reisha, it's not that way. And again, v'hainu de rapapa. And this is like rapapa, which means that the obligation for things that go wrong only stem from the moment when they go wrong, not from the original transaction. And that's why over here there is no obligation, even if there is land that was passed from the father to the children. And that's like Rapapa, who believes that the obligation stems from the moment of damage and not from the moment of the relationship or transaction. The Amar of Papa, and here is this statement of Rapapa, Haita para gnuvalo betavacha b'shabbat. If he had a para that he stole, and then he shechzen on Shabbat, chayav, he is responsible, shekvar chayav b'gneva, kodem shevo lidei isur Shabbat. Because he's already responsible for the gneva prior to the isur of Shabbat. The simplest way to read this is that the chiyuv gneva took place earlier, and therefore he's chayav for the kefel before he is now chayav for shechting an animal on Shabbat. And so therefore the isur mitah that is associated with shechting on Shabbat happens after the gneva, and there's no kamle derabe mine. Rashi, on the other hand, offers an alternative way to read this, which is that not only is he chayav in the gneva, he's also chayav in the arba'a v'chamisha, in the 4 or 5 times for stealing an animal and shechting it. And that is because, yes, the gneva happened earlier. So that's as far as the karen, the principal amount, is concerned, that he's already obligated in. But as far as the arba and chamisha, which is added on top of the kefel, which really means 3 or 4 times above the kefel, the additional 3 or 4 times that he's chayav is all a knas. And we believe that when it comes to kamlei d'berabe minei, that only has application when you're talking about mita and mamon. But by mita and knas, it does not apply. A knas, a fine, is imposed irrespective of the fact that there is a chiyuv mita. And therefore Rashi says over here that the first statement of Rapapa says he's chayav arba v'chamisha plus chiyuv mita for Shabbat. Hayta para she'ulalo. If he had borrowed it, v'tavacha b'Shabbat, and then he shechzen on Shabbat, patur. In that case, he is patur. She'isur Shabbat, v'isur gneva, ba'im ke'echad. Because over here, the violation of Shabbat and the violation of the isur gzela happen simultaneously. Because, as we've said till now, Rav Papa's belief is that the obligation for problems that arise in the relationship stems from the moment of the problem. And over here, he stole it at that moment because he misappropriated it. He shechted it when it was borrowed and it wasn't his. So that's the moment of the obligation for the stealing, but it's also the moment that he's now chayav mitah for Shabbat. And therefore it is kamle derabe minei, and it overrides the need to make payment over here. Now, as Rashi notes over here, the payment here is simply Karen. Here he is a gazlan, and since he is a gazlan, the only payment here is Karen, is the original mamon. And since Karen is mamon, and you have mita mamon, we say kamla dirabe minei, and therefore the gazlan here, the shoel, does not have to make that payment because he's subject to the death penalty. Rashi then brings an alternative from his rebbeim, which he says he does not understand, which is that the tour here in the second case derives from the fact that since the obligation for the principal amount only came at the moment that he was chayav for the Isha Shabbat, as opposed to the previous case where the Gneva preceded the Tvicha, and therefore the obligation for the Karen was already done. The Knas for the additional Shechita, that's all Knas, and there's no Kamle D'Rabbe Mineh. In our case, the Gneva and the Tvicha happened simultaneously with his shechting of it on Shabbat. And therefore, both the Karen, the principal amount, which is Mamon, and the Karen all come into an obligation at that same moment that he's shechting the animal and being chayav for Shabbat. So you're right. Vis-a-vis the Knas, the Mitah will not override that with Kamle Derabe Mineh. But vis-a-vis the Karen, the principal amount, which is Mamon, it will override it. And we have a principle that you pay Arba V'Chamisha, and you don't pay, because if you eliminate the principal amount, then you'd only be paying 3 or 4 times and not 4 or 5 times. And for that reason, there's no payment here of the Karen as well as the Knas for the Arba V'Chamisha. Now, in theory, what his Rebbeim are saying is true, and Rashi acknowledges that. He says he just doesn't understand the application in this situation, because he says the only way you could be Chayav for Kefel or Arba'a v'chamisha is in situations or scenarios where the individual is a ganav. That's either where he himself stole it and he is a ganav, or in a case of a shomer chinam who's toein tanat ganav, where he makes a claim of gneva, which is poter him from his responsibilities as a shomer. And maybe for a shomer sachar, when he's toein tanat ganav by unzin, maybe you can come up a case with that. But with regards to shoel, where a tanat ganav would not exempt him from any responsibilities, then there's never a scenario where you can come up where a guy would be chayav kefel, or he'd be chayav arba v'chamisha when he steals the item. He's not deemed to be a ganav. He is either a gazlan, because he stole the item here when he was a shoel, and he is deemed to be a gazlan, or in the case of toein tanat ganav, which is not applicable by a shoel. And so what Rashi says is, in theory, they are right, but you can never come up with a scenario where that's true. And therefore, I believe that the basic statement of the Gemara here is simply that he's not chayav for the Karen, because the Kamlei Derabi Minei has nothing to do with the Kefel, the Arba v'Chamisha, because they aren't relevant in this scenario. Whereas in the first case that Rav Papa brought, it's clear that he is a Ganav, and we're speaking about the Ganav himself, not someone who has a prior relationship, and then misappropriates the item. Tarabanan. Veshevet the Gela Asher Gazal. He has an obligation to return the item that he stole. Matam Alomar Asher Gazal. What does it mean that he has to return the item that he stole? Yachzir Ke'en Shegazal. He has to return like the item that he had. Mikanamru. Aguzelam Achilet Banav Turim Elishalim. For this reason, we say someone who steals and then gives it to his children to eat, that they are Turim Elishalim. They have no obligation to return it because the item is no longer extant. It's almost as if the Gemara is reading Asher Gazal, not to be the item itself that it was stolen, but me, Asher Gazal, the person that actually stole it, has the obligation to return it. And since here we're talking about the children, they don't have any responsibility to return it. Or, because the item is no longer extant, only the one who stole it is responsible to make reparations, restitution to the individual he stole from. Children don't have that obligation since they are not the thieves. So if the item is not extant, they have no requirement to return it. Eniach lifnehem, ben gdolim, ben ktanim. If the item is still extant, whether the children are of age or minors, chayavin, they are responsible to return it. That is the shita of the Rabbanon, that as we mentioned in the Braita before, where there's an obligation on whatever the age of the children is to return the item when it's extant. Mishum sumchos amru, gdolim chayavim, ktanim turim. And this is what we said before, that according to Rashi, he's the author of the first Braita before, which is that only those children of age have a responsibility to return it. On the other hand, ktanim are pturim. They don't have a responsibility to return it because of the fact that they are minors. And since minors can't be brought to din or can't have claims made against them, they are not responsible to return the item, even if it is extant. Bar Chamua de Rabbi Yirmiyah, the son of the father-in-law of Rabbi Yirmiyah, which makes him Rabbi Yirmiyah's brother-in-law, Tarak Gali Bapei de Rabbi Yirmiyah. He went ahead and slammed the door in front of Rabbi Yirmiyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah was coming to make a claim to some room in the house, some part of the house, some land that his father-in-law had sold to him or given to him. And after the death of his father-in-law, he came to take possession of it. This young brother-in-law, who was a minor, slammed the door for to prevent him from coming and taking possession of the property. Ati dekamei d'Rabbi Avin. He went to Rabbi Avin to say, I want to get my property, I want to get it back, please help me with this case. Amar, shalohu toveya. He says that the young man, this young brother-in-law of yours, this minor, claims that it was his, and that you don't have any right to it. Amar lei, v'hamatina sa'adei da'achzgebei b'chayi avua. I'll bring a deem that I already took possession of the property prior to the death of his father. So my claim is not against the minor, and I'm saying that I had possession of it, but rather I'm saying that in the lifetime of his father already, I took possession of the item, and it's really mine. How can we accept edim when the counterparty is not present? We can only adjudicate a case or have witnesses come and give testimony when both parties are present. And over here, while you are present, your brother-in-law is not present. Now, even if he is physically present, as Rashi notes over here, Haikatan Kamadalet Dami, Since he's a minor, it's as if he doesn't exist. It's as if he's not there at all. V'haktani, wait a minute. Don't we have Braito to tell us? Ben Gdolim, Ben Gatanim Chayavim. Whether they were of age or they were minors, they have an obligation to return the item. So we see that we do allow for claims to be brought against minors and take possession of the item when it is extant. Amalei, hare machloket, sumchos b'tzidech. How could you say that? That's a machloket there between sumchos and the chachamim. You quoted me one of the two opinions. Amar ichpil kuli alma b'kai kasumchos, lafkun l'didi. He says, what? The whole world now rolled up or doubled down on sumchos to say that the halacha is like sumchos in order to take away my property? Why all of a sudden is the halacha like sumchos? Sumchos is a dat yachid. I'm bringing you the rabbanon. We're going to paskin like sumchos all of a sudden to prevent me from getting what is rightfully mine? Igalgal milta, ato mata the kamei derabbi avo. So they never came to a conclusion here, but the case ended up, we call it rolling, but being passed along until it reached Rabbi Abahu. Amar lo shmiluchu had Rabbi Yosef bar Chama ar Rabbi Yoshaya. Wait a minute, didn't you hear that which Rabbi Yosef bar Chama says in the name of Rabbi Yoshaya? Damar Rabbi Yosef bar Chama ar Rabbi Yoshaya. Tinok shitakaf ba'avadav. A tinok that forced, whether it's his servants, as Rashi says, or Rashi means another lashon, he forced his neighbor's servants to do work for him. Or he went down and took possession of his friend's property. So this is a minor who is using either his friend's abadim or going to his friend's property and saying that they are mine. Or he took his own abadim and went down into his friend's property and forced them to take possession of the property. And now he's exercising his right. V'amar shelihu. And he says, they're mine. Either the field is mine, the abadim are mine, or if the abadim are his, then just the field is mine. We don't say wait until he grows up, because we can't adjudicate with this kid since he's a minor now. So now we leave him and let him do what he wants until he grows up. We confiscate the item right away. And then when he grows up, he'll bring evidence to the fact that he's entitled to this. Vinira. And then we'll see whether he's really right or he's justified in what he did. Midomi. How can you compare the cases? Hatam hu demafkinan minei de lo kaimalei chazaka de avua. Because over there, he's not coming based on the chazaka of his father. He's coming and making a new claim. So now when he makes a new claim, we're not going to automatically assume he's correct and then not let anybody touch him. Because this is new evidence, it's a new situation. So in that case, we say to him, wait, when you get older, you'll come with your claim and you'll bring evidence to that fact. But in our case of Ahacha, Dile Chazaka Davua, over here in the case of Rabbi Yirmiyah, his brother-in-law is basing his claim not on his own, but on the fact that his father had a Chazaka on this property. So now, why would you confiscate the property from him? It's more likely, or the person that's Mugzak in the property, is Rabbi Yirmiyah's father-in-law and his brother-in-law, and therefore it would say, lo, that in that case we would not confiscate it, and we'd wait the other way around. We'd leave it in the hands of the katan until he got older, and then force Rabbi Yirmiyah at that point to bring evidence to the fact that he is entitled to the property. And Tosva notes over here that mashma da'ino afilu haya Rabbi Yirmiyah betoch habayit, that it wouldn't matter if Rabbi Yirmiyah actually got into the house. I mean, that happens to be a sidebar or a side detail here that the child closed the door and prevented him from entering. But it sounds like that even if Rabbi Yirmiyah had succeeded in going into the house or taking possession of what he said was rightfully his, we would still, mashman de lo tocha tali b'hachi midei, that it has nothing to do with that. El b'ma de'idle chazaka me'avot. I feel like Rabbi Yirmiyah mukzak b'bayit. The whole thing hinges on whether there is a chazaka of the father, or here the father-in-law, which would grant that right to the brother-in-law, or if there was no chazaka before, like the case of Rabbi Yosef bar Chama. The Tosfot says that the preliminary facts in the case that dealt with the fact that the child had blocked Rabbi Yirmiyah from coming in were actually relevant to the outcome of the case based on this, which is the outcome is solely determined by whether the child is coming with a claim of his father's ownership, in which case we would leave it as a default that he has ownership and then wait till he grows up to bring evidence to the contrary. Versus a case where he's giving a claim that does not involve his father's ownership or chazaka, where then we would leave it with the other owners until the katan grew up and brought a claim to the contrary. Amar Rav Ashi, Amar Rav Shabtai, Mikablim Edim, Shelo Bifnei Bal Din. we accept a deem even though one of the other parties is not there, in that both parties don't need to be there when we accept evidence. Ta'iba Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was perplexed by this. V'chi mekablim edim shelo bifnei bal din? How is it possible that we accept edim without a bal din? You can see here there's a note on the side that indicates that this may not be the Rav Ashi or the famous Rav Ashi we know in the Gemara, because this Rav Ashi that we're speaking about can't be Rav Ashi, the later Rav Ashi of the Gemara, the more famous Rav Ashi, because otherwise then why is Rabbi Yochanan Toiba? Why is Rabbi Yochanan perplexed by this statement? Because Rav Ashi lives many generations after Rabbi Yochanan. So therefore he claims that it must be a different Rav Ashi over here, an earlier Rav Ashi who Rabbi Yochanan is questioning, or you have to say that it is Rav Ashi that we know, except that he's the one quoting what Rabbi Yochanan's reaction would have been to this situation, not that this was actually Rabbi Yochanan's reaction to the situation. So, Kimlei Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina had this misora from Rav Ashi that this only applies in the following circumstance: Kohen Shayahu Chole, Oedav Cholim, in a case where the Baal Din is sick. Whether that means the Toveya is a Choleh and he wants to adjudicate this case before he passes away so that his Yorshim can get whatever it is, or it's the Nidba, the defendant here that is sick, and the claimant is afraid that once he passes away, he won't be able to get the money from the Yorshim. Or the Edim who are going to testify are sick, and as Rashi notes over here, it doesn't mean they're sick, but they're deathly ill where there is suspicion or risk that they won't be around to testify. Or the witnesses are going to travel overseas, and they call to the other party that is a party to this case, and he didn't show up. So then Beit Din accepts the Edim without him there because he was given ample chance to come and be a part of the case. Plus, we have a risk in timing here, which is that if we wait and then we try to force him to show up in court, by the time we're finished with that, there may not be any edim left to testify, or there may not be another claimant here to bring the case because of the circumstances that surround the edim or this baal din, whether it's because they are sick or that they are traveling overseas and we have no idea when they're going to return. Tosfot over here says he's not clear about how to read the circumstance in which this is true according to this qualification of Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina. Because he says that the way the statement works is it says that he was sick, or the edim were sick, or the possibility that they were going to travel overseas, and they sent for the other party and he didn't come. Tosa doesn't know whether the vishalchu is a vav chibur and saying and, that you need both things, you both need a timing issue, plus the fact that you sent to the other baal din and he didn't show up. Or whether the vav here is a vav of or, which is that whether it's there's a problem with some of the evidence or the claimant, and therefore we need to move the case along, or they sent for the other baal din and he didn't show up. And obviously the nafkamina is whether that sending for the other party is a prerequisite to allowing for the claim to go forward and the edim to testify without that other party, or whether just in and of itself the chance that these edim might disappear would be sufficient grounds to continue without the other party. Or the other way around, which is shalchu lo, and he didn't show up, sufficient grounds to go on with the case without him, even though there's no pressing issue because of the edim being sick or the claimant being sick. So Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Mekablim edim shelo bifnei baal din. Now we have a statement from Yehuda Amar Shmuel that says we do accept edim, even though both parties are not present. Amar Marukva, again, here we have a qualification of that statement of Shmuel, similar to what we have with Rav Ashi before, Ayidei Rav Yossi Bar Chanina, that they already opened up the case had begun, and they sent for the party, and then he didn't come. If they did not start the case yet, Matzi Amalei, he can say to them, meaning the party that's not showing up, Ana the Beit Din HaGadol Azilna. I want to go up to the Beit Din HaGadol in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore, I'm not going to show up in this court, because I want to take my case to Eretz Yisrael. Ihachi, the Gemara says, if that's the case, Kipat Cholei Nami. If they already opened up the gates, Why can he say, Matzarmelei, the Beitin HaGadol HaZilna? I want to already go up to the Beitin HaGadol. Why isn't that a fair claim in this instance? So, Amar Ravina, Kagon Danaka Diska, Beitin HaGadol. It's a case in which they have a letter already from the Beitin HaGadol that indicates that this Beitin should adjudicate the case, or that they want this Beitin to enforce whatever the din is over here, and therefore the counter no longer has that option to go back to the Beit Din HaGadol, because the Beit Din HaGadol already opined on this situation. So in that situation, he has no right to say, I'm going somewhere else. On the other hand, if there isn't such a letter, then he can demand that we go and adjudicate the case in the Beit Din HaGadol. Tosfot over here tries to understand, when exactly is this claim a fair claim? The first thing he says is, Perish Bahag, Umatzi Nitba Lishtemute Behochi. Only the defendant can use this as a claim to go up to Eretz Yisrael, but when it comes to the Toveya, the claimant, maybe that's not the case. Because otherwise, people could hold other parties hostage, and they can say, listen, either you pay me the 100, or you're coming with me up to the Beit Din HaGadol. And the expenditures and the time that's involved going up to the Beit Din HaGadol, then the claimant can force almost or extort from the defendant the money, because he'd rather just pay him the money than have to go up to the Beit Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim. And so for that reason, if he doesn't think that maybe the Toveya should be empowered. But he says, Avanir the Rabbeinu Tam, the Koshukein Toveya, that this claim or this ability to go to the Beit Din HaGadol is not only afforded to the defendant, but even to the claimant. Because when it comes to the defendant, it looks like he's playing games over here. The only reason he is saying that is to postpone the case and to make it impossible for the claimant to go get the money. So if he's doing it, what seemingly is an underhanded manner to get out of having to make the payment, then certainly the claimant can make such a demand that they go up to Beit Din HaGadol. Koshukein the Toveya, Shemitchilo Toveya Kach, who from the beginning says that that's what he wants to do. And it doesn't look like he's playing games, because up front he says, I want to go to the Beit Din HaGadol. So the Rabbeinu Tam believes that this option is open to the Toveya, to the claimant as well, whereas the Bahag limits it to the Nidba, to the defendant. Now Tosafot says, what about the fact that the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that one of the two parties can compel the other party to go to the Beit Avad? The Beit Avad is the biggest court in Bavel. And over there, we have a qualification by a Maimar that says that only the Malveh, only the creditor can do this. But the Loveh has no right to do that. The Malveh has a right to do that based on the Pasuk that says, Loveh Eved Ish Malveh, that the debtor basically is completely subjugated to the creditor. And therefore, the creditor can make any claim or any demand, and it can force him to go to the Beit Avad, to the biggest Beit Din in Bavel. But the Loveh does not have that right. Over here, it seems like the Loveh, the debtor, who would be the defendant in the case, does have the right to demand that they go up to Beit Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim. And so what Tosfot says is, Beit Avad, lav hainu Beit Din HaGadol, that there is a difference. Beit Avad is not the highest court. The highest court is the Beit Din HaGadol in Eretz Yisrael. And there the Loveh does have a right, or the defendant does have a right to go to that Beit Din. The other hand, the Beit Avad, which is a fixed court in Bavel, or the highest court in Bavel, over there, since they have somebody who's above them, the defendant doesn't have a right to force the creditor to go there. And that's the difference between these two cases as to when the defendant can make this claim and cannot make this claim. Now, Amarav, Mikayim et Ashtar, you're allowed to be Mikayim Ashtar, which means that you have Edim signed on the shtar. And now we have evidence or Edim who tell us what these are the signatures of so-and-so, or the people who signed on the shtar are corroborating that that's their signature. Shelo bifnei baldin, even if the other party is not present. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Ein mikayim et hashtar, shelo bifnei baldin. Rabbi Yochanan, consistent with his opinion before, says that you cannot be mikayim hashtar unless both parties are present at the time. Amalei Rav Sheshet, the Rabbi Yossi Baravua, Asavru lecha, Tami de Rabbi Yochanan. I'll explain to you the reasoning behind Rabbi Yochanan's position. Amar kra, vehu ad bibalav, velo yishmerenu amra tovra. The Torah says that you have to, in front of the owner, tell him what was wrong, and that he didn't watch it, and therefore he's responsible. Amra Torah, yavo balashor via modal shoro. That the owner of the shore has to be present when you are adjudicating a case that is against his possession. And so therefore you see that There is a demand that the Baldin be present whenever there is a claim being brought against him. And so too by the Kiumashtar, if there is a defendant in the case who the shtar is going to collect against, he has to be present when you're being mekayim the shtar. And so too above, where Rabbi Yochanan said that we don't accept a deem unless the other party is present. Over here, the Bali HaTosafot tried to limit the machloket here between Rabbi Yochanan and Rav, that Rav's statement here is only true with regards to Kiyum HaShtar, that fundamentally he agrees with Rabbi Yochanan's basic position that the Bali Dinim have to be present when there is a case being adjudicated. He only disagrees with regards to Kiyum HaShtar, because Kiyum HaShtar is a Din Derabonon. And since it's a Din Derabonon, Derabonon over here waive the necessity for the Baal Din to be present. Because Midoraita, Edim and Ashtar are considered to be as if Nechruku Edetan, and it's a full-fledged, as if court-enforced document at that time. So their requirement that the Edim come and corroborate their signatures is only a requirement Midorabanan. And therefore the Rabbanan waived the necessity to have it be done in front of the Baal Edinim. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan disagrees and says that the Rabbanan did this Kein Doraita. And just like in a case Doraita, you would require the Baal Din to be present, so too would be the case with regards to Kiyum HaShtar. So therefore, he limits the Machloket here between Rav and Rabbi Yochanan to simply Kiyum HaShtar Midrabanan, but fundamentally that they both agree that this necessity for adjudicating cases in front of the parties is present with the exception of Kiyum HaShtar. Rashi over here also limits Rav's situation to a case where the Edim want to take off or they need to leave. Meaning similar to the cases before where we saw the qualification of the statements about doing or adjudicating cases without the other Baal Din, accepting Edim without the other Baal Din be present, when there was some sort of duress or necessity to move the case along, that's when it's true. And Rashi says the same thing here. Tosafot, the read here says, Ein ni radari, because he says, Imkeim, am I not cut kiyum shtar? Why would then it just specify the case of kiyum shtar? It should have mentioned any kabbalat ha'edim, as if it's similar to all the cases we had above. The fact that they specifically argue in the case of kiyum shtar, Tosafot says that it's even in a case where the edim are not going to leave us, or there's no pressure to move the case along. And this is where Rav disagrees, because of what we said before, that it's a din derabonon and not a din d'oraita. Tosfot points out that the Raya of Rabbi Yochanan is really only an asmachta bi'alma because of the fact that kiyum shtarot is only midrabanan. But then there are others who say, well, if that's the case, that the proof from Rabbi Yochanan is only an asmachta because we're talking about kiyum shtarot derabanan, you could take that one step further, that maybe Rabbi Yochanan's din is only applicable by din nefashot, because the proof that he brings is from capital cases, a case where the shor might be put to death. Maybe it doesn't apply to dinei mimononot at all, and it would only be an asmachta by dinei mimononot. And therefore, Rav, who disagrees with Rabbi Yochanan, doesn't just disagree with regards to kiyum shtarot. Maybe he disagrees with all cases of mamon, because Rabbi Yochanan's proof is only really by cases of capital punishment. And therefore, the Rashba concludes over here, similar to Tosafot, that Rav agrees to Rabbi Yochanan's position, but he only agrees in cases of Dinei Nefashot, not in cases of Dinei Mimonot. So he expands the scope of their machloket to include all Dinei Mimonot and not just Kiyum Shtarot. Amar Rava, Hilchata Mikaimim Et Ashtar Shelo Bifnei Baal Din. Rava says the locha here is like Rav, that we are Mikaim the Shtar, even if the Baal Din is not present. Va'afilu Omeid Vitzoveyach. And that's even if the counterparty, the defendant over here, is screaming that it is a false shtar, it's a forged shtar, we still allow the edim to come and corroborate the fact that there is their signatures. V'yamar nikitu li zimna admatinu sa'ade, umarana le l'shtara. If he says then, give me some time so I can prove to you that it's a forgery or that there's some problem with the shtar, naktinale, we give him that time. Because we want to get the fact, or we want to get the evidence of the fact that the signatories to the shtar are real signatories, and that they signed what was on there. Now you want to undermine the shtar, you want to ruin the shtar, we'll give you time to do that if you ask for that amount of time. But that's not going to change the fact that we are going to figure out or find out or get the evidence of the fact that these edim that signed on it, that is their signature, and it wasn't a false signature. Iata'ato, if he brings evidence to show that the shtar is a forgery, then fine. Iloato, if he does not bring evidence, Natrinanlay Bahab, we wait for him Monday, Thursday, Monday, meaning that we wait for him 8 days. Iloato, if he doesn't come at that point, Kadvinan Ticha Ilave Tishin Yomim. We write the opening salvo, we'll call it, for 90 days, which is, according to Rashi, that they put him into Shamta, they put him into excommunication based on the fact that he hasn't responded to the claim here, or he's not dealing with the fact that he owes the money. Now, we do not allow the creditor to foreclose yet, because we're going to see in the Gemara that there are reasons why he might be delaying over here. Tlatin kamai lo nachtinan nechsei. For the first 30 days, we don't foreclose on his property. Damar katarach bezuze vinizov. He's trying to raise money or borrow money in order to pay back the creditor over here. Mitzaye, the second set of 30 days, the middle 30 days, namilo nachtinan le nechsei, we don't grant the foreclosure. Damar dimolo ashkach the mezov. He wasn't successful at finding someone who would lend him money. And now he's trying to sell property in order to raise cash to pay back the creditor. But try namilo nachtina next day. The latter 30 days, in the final 30 days of the 90 days, we don't allow for a foreclosure. Damar lokeach gufei katarach bezuze. We say that maybe he did find someone to buy the property, but now the buyer needs to raise the cash in order to pay him for it. So we give him a window of 90 days, assuming that he is going to try to pay back this creditor, because he has yet to bring evidence of the fact that the shtar is problematic. But we already put him into shamta. I mean, if we put him in this first stage of being in violation of the word of Beit Din or the necessity to pay over here, but we don't allow for a foreclosure. So we're giving him some more time to deal with the issue, but we're also assuming that this individual is not acting appropriately by not addressing this situation or by not giving the money now. So we open with this shtar that says he is now in shamta, but we have yet to allow the creditor to foreclose and go down and grab his property. And it seems from the Gemara here that it's broken down into three periods of 30 days, which possibly would indicate the fact that the Beit Din might send out to him to pay every 30 days, ask him to pay, and the lack of response is what keeps him in this shamta, or his lack of payment to the creditor is what keeps him in the shamta for the 90-day period, even though we're lomeda labzchut, the fact that maybe he is trying to pay it, but his lack of communication, his lack of payment, is a problem. Lo ato, at that point, after the 90 days, he doesn't show up. Katvina na drachta nechse. Then we write a foreclosure document for the creditor. And a drachta means a right to collect from the debtor's property wherever it is found, that the creditor can then get the Beit Din to confiscate the property and sell it in order to raise the money that is owed to the creditor. V'hanin mili damar atina. That's only if he says, I'm going to bring something. That's only if he says that he's coming to Beit Din, but then doesn't show up. Or he says that I'm going to pay it, and he doesn't end up paying it. Aval amar lo atina, the altar kadvina. If he says that I'm not coming, then we write it right away. Meaning that as long as he is indicating to us that he is trying, or we're not getting clear answers from him, but we think, or possibly he's trying, then we give him this window of opportunity. But if he says straight out, I'm not intending to pay, or I'm not intending to listen to the Beit Din, then right away, we write this foreclosure document. This is also only true in cases of a borrowing. In a case where the shomer took the pikadon, misappropriated the pikadon, or did something wrong, then we write the adrachta, the foreclosure document, right away. Because over there we say that it wasn't a case where he borrowed the money. He did something wrong. He was sholeach yad. He was irresponsible with the other person's object. Right away we're going to make a demand that either he pays it back right away, or we're going to foreclose on his property as a penalty for the fact that he acted inappropriately. By the case of the debtor, he was trying, or we can assume that he was trying to pay it back, and therefore, we give him more of a window of time to actually make payments in this situation. When we do write the adrachta, when we do write this foreclosure document, we only write it for land or confiscation of land, of a metaltele lo, but not for non-real property. Because what we're worried about is the fact that the creditor might take the foreclosed item, consume it, utilize it, the metaltele, to those non-real property. In the end, when the debtor shows up with actual edim to prove his point, umar le the shtara, and he proves that the shtar was a forgery, lo mishkach mide le mikvah. The item that was taken from the debtor was already consumed by the creditor, and the creditor no longer has a way to pay him back. So we don't want to put the debtor in a position where if he finally brings evidence to corroborate his stance, that he can't get his money back. If the malve actually has property, kadvina, then we can write it, because then you could just do the foreclosure in reversal. Velohi, that's not the case. The Gemara says, adrachta metautaleg lo kadvina. We do not write an adrachta foreclosure document on metautale. Afagav ditle mekarkage. Even if the creditor has property, chashinan shema tichsif, we worry about the fact that the property might go down in value or diminish in value, and then the debtor would be out of the money, even though the creditor foreclosed inappropriately. So we only allow foreclosure where the debtor has a right or an ability to get back whatever it was foreclosed on, in case the debtor brings evidence of the fact that he doesn't owe the money. And when we do write this foreclosure document, we inform him of the fact that that's the case, that we tell the debtor that we are now going to foreclose on your property, so he's aware of that fact. That's only true if he's nearby and he's easily reached. Aval mirchak lo. If he's far away, then we don't inform him, because we're not going to allow him then basically to run away and then leaves the creditor out his money forever. So we're going to write the foreclosure document right away, even though we can't communicate or tell the debtor that we're going to do that. So we give him a last chance to respond before we give the foreclosure document. That only assumes that he's present, and that's not going to forestall our ability to allow the creditor to collect his money. V'mirchak, v'ikakrovim, if the debtor is far away and he has relatives, inami ika shayarta, or there are constant caravans that are traveling between our location and where the debtor is, the azvatu lehatam, and they go back and forth, v'shayinen lay treser yarcheshata. We wait 12 months, ada azla, v'ayti shayarta, the amount of time it will take for the caravans to reach the debtor and to return, ki'ada ravina, like a case that came before Ravina, Shahalamar Acha Tresar Yarcheshata. He delayed giving a foreclosure document to Mar Acha out of the Azlav Achi Sheartha Mi Bechuzai, until the caravans had gone back and forth to Bechuzai to inform the debtor of the fact that they were going to write a foreclosure document. Below he, Gemara says that's not a proof in the case of Ravina, Hatam Inish Ali Mahava. Over there, Mar Acha was a strong man, or he was a well-positioned political figure. He have Yamati Adrachta Liyadei. Once he had gotten a foreclosure document, of Afshala Fuke Mine, there'd be no possibility of reversing the situation or getting the money back for the debtor. So therefore, we didn't want to jump the gun and give the foreclosure document, because that would be an irreversible development in the case. And so we wanted to give the debtor a chance at least to respond before we wrote the foreclosure document. And that's why we waited the extra time. Of Ahacha, lo natrinan lei ela da azil shlicha betlata b'shabta va'ata ba'arba'a b'shabta o lecham shabshata kai b'dine. But in a normal case, we would only allow the shliach beitin to go out on tlata b'shabta, means on Tuesday. Yeah, we assume the case was brought on a Monday. The shliach beitin would travel on Tuesday, come back on Wednesday, and the debtor would be present on the Thursday. That's the amount of time we're going to wait for the debtor. If we have to wait more than that, then we just write the foreclosure, even though they won't be a last warning or the debtor would not be informed about the foreclosure. Amar Ravina, hay shlucha derabonan mehemnin le kebeit rei. These sheriffs, we'll call them, of the Beit Din, who sent out to inform the defendant that a court case is being brought against him, and they want him to show up in court, we believe him like two edim. V'ani mile l'shamta. That's only true with regards to the shamta. Aval l'pticha. But when it comes to the writing of the shtar p'ticha, kevin de mamona kamichser lei, de kavai le meitiv le zuzah le safra lo. Over there, since he's going to cause a monetary loss to the defendant, over there we can't believe him because there's monetary matter involved. So when it comes to the fact that they send out this individual to find out if this person or this defendant will show up in the court case, and he says, I'm not coming. So then the shliach beit din is believed that he's not coming, and the beit din will put him into shamta, they'll excommunicate him for the fact that he's not willing to show up or attend the court case that is being brought against him. But as far as writing the shtar p'ticha, which then says that we're starting the 90-day count against him and demanding that he makes payment Two, which will lead into the draft of the foreclosure document. The Peticha is a document of the court that requires someone to pay a sofer to write that document. Someone has to underwrite that. That's the obligation. In the end, will be the obligation of the defendant, because the court had to make the document because of his refusal to come. Since he'll be responsible for that payment, the Shliach Beit Din as a single aid can't make him responsible or obligate him in that payment. And therefore, we need two aidim in that case in order to generate that obligation. Amar Ravina, Yavina and Zimna Apuma di Itida. If we want to invite someone to a court case, basically subpoena them to show up in the case, we leave the information with a woman, or possibly Itida over here might be with his wife, Apuma de Shivive, or with the neighbors. Velo Amran ela delete bamato. That's only true if the individual is not found in the city. Because Avalita bamato, if he's found in the city, lo, you can't leave that information with his wife or with the neighbors or with the woman. Darminan Amar Damrinan, we could say then, Amar lo Amrule, the Shlichim, or these individuals who we left the message with, did not pass it on to him. Damri Ashkachino Shlicha de Beitin, because they figured the Shliach Beit Din found him since he was in the city, Vamarle, and he told them. And therefore they forget or they don't tell him the information because they assume the Shliach Beit Din caught up with him. Vomram lo Khalifa Baba de Beidina. And it's also in a case where he's not passing by on his daily travels or somehow in front of the Beit Din. The Khalifa Baba de Beidina, if he does pass by in front of the Beit Din, lo, then we do not say that, or we do not assume that they passed the message to him. Amre, because they'll say, Ashkahua Beit Din, Vamrule. Because the Beit Din found him, they told him the information, and therefore we don't need to pass on the information to him. So we do not rely on these individuals to pass the invitation or the requirement to show up in court unless they feel that they are the only ones who have the information and it's incumbent upon them to tell him this information. If they somehow can think that they got the information to him without them, then we cannot rely on them. So that's both in the case where he's in the city and Shliach Beit Din might have bumped into him, or in the case we passed in front of the Beit Din where they can make this assumption that he found the information, they no longer have to convey it to him. It's only true if he's coming back on that day. If he's not coming back that day, we do not trust these individuals. Because we're afraid that they're going to forget about it. They're not going to remember to pass the information around. An individual who has a court document saying that he's refusing to come to the Beit Din and therefore he's in Shamta. Until he shows up for the court case, then we do not rip up the shtar until he physically shows up for the court case. If a document is written that he refuses to comply with the psak of the Beit Din, then we don't rip up that document that incriminates him or puts him into shamta, until he listens or obeys the instructions of Beit Din, we do not rip it up. And the Gemara says that's not the case. If he says that I'm going to listen to the psak of the Beit Din, then we already rip it up. So as opposed to the case where he refuses to show up in Beit Din, there, even if he says I'm coming, we do not waive his necessity to show up in Din, because it's a chutzpah. It is a denial of the jurisdiction of Beit Din for him to not show up in a case where he's invited or subpoenaed to come to the court. And therefore, until he shows up, we will not eliminate that document. On the other hand, when it comes to the psak of Beit Din, over there, again, we're going to be malamed zchut on this individual, that he's really just trying to buy time until he can find the money to pay or to fulfill the obligation of Beit Din. And therefore, when he already indicates that I'm going to listen or that I am complying with the Beit Din, then we're already willing to rip it up, even if he has yet to make that payment. His affirmation or confirmation that he's going to listen to the Beit Din in that case is sufficient, again, because we could be malamed zchut as to why he didn't listen up front. And therefore, as soon as he acquiesces to listen, we will rip up the document. Okay, we're going to stop here at the two dots on the top of Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph.